We need to think about the ecosystems that girls live within in order to counteract this narrative. That's what we need to address, right? And at the same time, we must center the leadership of girls to create the conditions they need for themselves, their families, and their communities to thrive.
We have to do our own work through critical self-reflection to examine our own beliefs, values, biases, and confront those through education, through understanding, through community building. And as we start to understand and have a shared perspective or a worldview or lens around JEDI, then we can all work together to apply that lens to policies, practices, procedures. I think the work is inside out, acknowledging my own biases and opportunities for growth, working on my own growth so that we can then fix our institutions and systems.
Welcome, Christian, and welcome, Aaliyah. To get us started, a little context. This is Ties Perspectives Audio Stories, where we highlight leaders and the work of Tides in order for us to contribute and share some of our learnings, some of our experiences within the nonprofit industry, and hopefully play a role in improving the work that we can do in philanthropy and nonprofit at large. I want to also acknowledge that we are celebrating Black History Month, Black Excellence, Black Leaders. Also, though, I want to frame this conversation under the recent publications of some of the challenges that Black leaders have been facing, specifically Black women in leadership positions, in executive positions, where we have seen them be targeted by organized political campaigns to oust them. Some folks also have been struggling in terms of their emotional and mental health, and we have research to cite a little bit later. But that is the framing of this conversation, and I want to tap y'all in as leaders within the community, as part of the Tides Black Caucus ERG with expertise in specific segments in philanthropic work. So, can I have just a quick intro from y'all? Let me start with Christian Friend, Senior Director of JEDI, Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion here at Tides. Could you just give us a quick intro about yourself?
Sure. Thank you, Christian. Again, my name's Christian Friend. I always tell people that's my real name. That's what my mother named me. I didn't make it up for marketing purposes. I am the Senior Director of what we call JEDI here at Tides. Professionally, I've had experiences in nonprofit organizations and public education, as well as philanthropy. So excited to be with you both and have this conversation today.
Cool. Thanks, Christian. And it is a great name. Let me say, Christian Friend, yeah. That makes you so approachable. I remember seeing your name pop up. I was like, this is a great name.
Thank you. I try to live up to it.
Aaliyah, could you bless us with an intro as well?
Absolutely. And I feel like I have to compete with Christian with such a great name.
Oh, no.
My name is Aaliyah Stevenson. And just a shout out to Black History Month, I was named after the Muhammad Ali. I am. Yes. So I'm a development manager with Tides, and I'm actually in my first year with Tides. So my history and my background is in nonprofits, as a consultant as well, working in the health equity, racial equity space, and specifically with Black women and girls led initiatives. So super excited to be here and to share about my role in Tides with the Advancing Girls Fund.
Awesome. I've worked with you on some of the Advancing Girls Fund projects, and I'm very excited to hear your takeaways and some learnings there. So let me start with you, Christian. Can you give us a quick overview of your approach to implementing JEDI at an organization and specifically within this nonprofit sector? When we were initially talking, just to frame this question a little bit more, I wanted to note that sometimes I've seen DEI work and JEDI work be taken for granted or simply assumed that it's happening because an organization is a nonprofit. But that's not the case, right? It takes active involvement. It takes active investment to be impactful with JEDI work. So could you give us your thoughts and your approach in terms of implementing JEDI at Tides and at an organization?
Yeah. So first, let me just start by saying it's an important framing to say that people assume if you're a nonprofit organization, and in particular one who's got a mission that's focused on social justice, that that just automatically brings people in who are aligned and everything's going to work perfectly in terms of diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice. I'll also add that one of the things I appreciate about Tides is the framing around equity and justice, the J and E and JEDI. Historically, folks have started on diversity initiatives and even worked to be more inclusive as an organization. Equity is about outcomes. It's looking at differential outcomes at kind of the systemic or structural level and saying, how do we close these gaps? How do we make sure that the outcomes are equitable for all groups, and with a particular focus on the marginalized groups who've been harmed by systemic oppression? And then the justice piece forces us to look at structures, not just individual relationships or how one institution works, but how we as a country and as a society have created these tools of oppression, and then how we undo some of what we've done. So the way I think about it, rolling out in an organization, is both bottom up and top down. And I don't mean the org chart. I mean bottom up in the sense of we start by thinking about what implicit bias is, how our brains work as human beings, and the assumptions we carry, and how to undo some of the biases that we might be socialized into. At the same time, we think about the systemic or structural approach of what is white supremacy broadly in the United States, and how has it influenced a given institution? And by doing both of those types of work, you can arrive at a place where we have a shared understanding of JEDI, and we can take steps individually and collectively to address it.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you said that the assumption happens because people think that because an organization is mission-driven, it automatically attracts people who have already done all the work that has to be done, but that is not the case. And you are naming that there is still work to be done on the individual level to address these biases, and maybe even more especially at a nonprofit.
Absolutely. And it starts with the understanding that we all have them. I am not exempt. None of us are exempt. We are socialized, meaning what we see on TV, what we read in the newspaper, carry messages that we internalize intentionally or unintentionally. And so it's important to be honest with ourselves and each other about that and to do the work. And then finally, I'll just say, to your point, Christian, there's never an endpoint on this. There's progress that can be made. There's advances that can be made. Dr. King says the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. We're talking about something we're doing for the universe, and that means it's consistent and must be persistent work.
Consistent and persistent. I like that balance where you do have a little bit more of a push in the persistency side. Thank you for sharing that, Christian.
Sure.
Let me ask you, Aliyah, could you give us a little bit more context about the previously mentioned Advancing Girls Fund? Can you give us this focus and its drive and a little bit more about your role? Because you are specifically a development manager under the philanthropy segment and even more specifically for the Advancing Girls Fund.
Yes, thank you. The fund itself really does have the opportunity to be super impactful. The Advancing Girls Fund invests in the leadership, well-being, and advocacy of girls and young women of color and their allies to create a more just and equitable world. The fund consists of over 170 partners impacting millions of girls across the U.S. and in over 20 countries, so it's big. It's also a very diverse portfolio. So girls and young women are working on some of the most pressing social issues of our time. Those might include economic justice, educational equity, gender equality in health, criminal justice, democracy, and climate justice. Girls are advancing incredible innovations in these areas. So despite the fact that they're at the front lines of these movements, they are grossly underfunded with less than 1% of foundation funding. My opportunity as the development manager with the Advancing Girls Fund is to elevate the incredible work of girls that they're advancing through our grantee partners, to invite and work alongside aligned donors to invest in these creative and resilient leaders. It's an incredible time to be in this work. I know we're going to talk about the current context, but the COVID-19 pandemic has exacerbated the challenges faced by girls and young women. We can talk about the rising mental health issues, issues of isolation, exposure to violence. Combine those things with the attacks on gender justice and the critical elections on the horizon. We must move quickly and with intentionality. And that's what we're excited to do at Tides.
Can you please, just for reiteration, give me that stat on that 1%?
When you look at overall funding for girls and women from foundations overall, it's less than 2%. But when you specifically zoom in on funding for girls and young women of color, we're getting around the half percentage point.
That is tough, and that is saddening. Though I do want to reiterate the work to be able to shift more funds into the sector. I had worked on an event for y'all, and we had a landscape analysis of the findings of y'all's research, and then also the money being moved into the sector by TIDES, mm-hmm. and the goals to move even more money. And I think I am starting to see a connection between the implementation of these philanthropic programs and also what Christian had previously mentioned about being persistent and consistent in terms of being able to push for shifts structurally to be able to get these systems and programs up and running. I want to dive into the topic of Black leadership. And just to reference, there have been recent publications that pointed out the need to support Black leadership, specifically Black women in executive positions. And to reference a recent article by Nonprofit Quarterly titled "The State of Black Women Leadership is in Danger," they referenced a report by the Washington Area Women's Foundation that says, even if there is a rise of Black women in leadership positions, in these executive positions as CEOs, as top executives, there is a lack of necessary infrastructure to support their leadership. And two data points are, out of all the CEOs and presidents, executive directors that they surveyed for the report, nearly 70% of them agree that Black women's leadership has been noticeably under attack in recent years. And even higher is that 90% of respondents expressed that their occupations have had detrimental effects on their health and well-being, manifesting as chronic stress, fatigue, elevated blood pressure, and impacts on mental health. We were just talking about that was one of the findings of the Advancing Girls survey and landscape analysis, that even at a younger age, these communities are being impacted, especially their mental health is under stress right now. So I want to ask Christian, from an organizational and structural lens, in regard to this specific topic of supporting Black women in leadership positions, what are you seeing as the points to improve? And what is that hopeful creation of a better structure? What can we work on structurally to support these Black women in leadership positions? And I have a note to shout out Kimberly Crenshaw, who coined intersectionality, because I think it's very relevant in this specific topic, because we have intersections of power where a Black leader who is a woman is in a leadership position structurally, organizationally, that's a lot of institutional power to be a CEO. But there's the intersecting identities of being Black, of being a woman, and the history of marginalization and the weight that that carries, and how you are seen even within our current society. So before I go off on a thesis and an ethnic studies rant, can I ask you, Dr. Christian Friend, for a little insight from what you are seeing in terms of this organizational lens?
Yeah, a few things. First of all, I want to take a step back to Aaliyah's point about like the direction of the funding and that little bit that goes to girls and young women of color. And that's a perfect example of an inequity, right? That's a perfect example of structural oppression, because they certainly make up a larger percentage of the population than that. So even if things were equal, even the funding was distributed equally, then you would think there'd be more of the funding that goes there. Then you layer on top the fact that this is a group that has historically been oppressed, and which brings me to my second point, that this is not a new issue. Women of color, and Black women in particular, have always been under attack in the United States and around the world. they have been utilized, their bodies, their brains, their feelings and emotions. We have a well-documented history of utilizing the reproductive rights of Black women to advance our society. You can think about how they were used during chattel slavery in the United States. And so then we move forward, not that many years, a few hundred years, and we see that there's these outcomes. And I think Time Magazine had a statistic about the suicide rates for young Black girls that are skyrocketing. And you say, well, what's happened? What's going on right now? And you have to understand, like, the trauma, the oppression that Black women experience broadly, just by their existence, they're under attack. And then you layer in the idea that they do have this intersectional identity, where I can acknowledge that as a Black man, an African-American man, I hold a position of privilege as a man. There are Black women who experience things in terms of marginalization and oppression that I never will, just by my unwanted privilege of being a man. And so the historical factors combined with what folks are experiencing, and then I'll layer in one final thought, and that is the idea that many folks think that after an Obama presidency, we live in this post-racial, equitable society, when in reality, the systemic oppression that created these differences in outcomes has never been addressed. And so while someone might get a position, the systemic and institutional structures that have oppressed them, in particular women of color and Black women, haven't changed. So yes, they might be a CEO, but in that CEO position, they might come in under attack by their board or staff. They might come in underpaid for their position. There's certainly a gender wage gap we would see in the statistics if we looked at them closely. So it's just to point out that it's a historical issue. It's being exacerbated now, as Aaliyah pointed out, by some of our economic and social circumstances. And while people have thought that placement of people in positions is a solution, in reality, in many ways, it's a setup for failure and further pain for women of color.
Snaps to that. I had to say that because Aaliyah was snapping. But also, what you brought up reminds me of this framework by an educator, Jeff Duncan Andrade, who wrote about critical hope and how the Obama presidency was used to exacerbate mythical hope, where, look, a Black man is president, there's no more racism, and you can do it just as long as you work hard, and there's nothing in your way, rather than critical hope being able to provide support while still addressing the inequities that you had previously said is still ongoing. Right? Can I ask just a little bit more, Christian, what can you see in terms of us implementing from an organizational lens support for a Black woman leader, right? If we are in an organization that has a Black woman as our leader, how should we be framing our thinking, or what should be on the forefront of our minds as individuals within an organization with a Black leader?
Yeah, I think this is true of an organization that has a Black woman as a leader, but it's equally true in any organization. And I think the first step is to acknowledge our own positions of privilege and biases. And when we start by, for example, my saying, like, my CEO, who's a Black woman, might have a position of authority and power in this workplace, in a hierarchical organizational structure, and I have to recognize that I bring male privilege into the meeting, even if it's just the two of us meeting, and that society will look at us differently. And so when I come with that, then I am able to then be a lot more empathetic. My acknowledging my privilege, anyone acknowledging their privilege, helps them to be more empathetic, number one. And number two, it becomes a lot clearer where the structures, policies, procedures are advantaging or disadvantaging someone else. And so again, bottom up or inside out, just the idea that I, as an employee, need to do my work to say, what are the positions of privilege that I occupy? How does that show up in my interactions? And what can I do to ensure that I'm not operating in those biases? I think it's the first step.
There's so much interplay between the institutional and the individual, and then how that plays out in the interpersonal that you just brought up. Like, how do you show up in a meeting, even if you are in a meeting with your CEO? Thank you for that context. And I think that's a perfect segue to talking about institutional support for Black women leaders and then also young girls and women of color. So for Aaliyah, your work with the Advancing Girls Fund has given you an insight in terms of the systems of support needed for young girls and women. Could you give us a little bit more of your insight on building out more support mm-hmm. earlier on rather than having band-aid solutions when people are already in crisis, mm-hmm. once they are already in leadership positions and experiencing challenges? Can we get them support earlier in the pipeline? And if so, what are you seeing as opportunities of hope there?
Yeah, I just want to build off what you've begun to talk about, Christian, and also just I want to reiterate also what was just shared. I think it's important to reiterate and call out the fact that these attacks on Black women's leadership or even exclusion from leadership opportunities may have been more noticeable in recent years with the report that you referenced from the Washington Area Women's Foundation on the state of Black women's leadership being in danger. And as we've recently seen with Dr. Gay, the former president of Harvard, being pushed out after serving the shortest presidency in the university's history. And of course, the recent suicide of Dr. Kenita Bailey at Lincoln University. So although we are incredibly grateful, and I'm incredibly grateful for the attention that's being directed now at this alarming issue, we also want to highlight that these attacks are not a new phenomenon. So I just want to reiterate that. And we don't even need to turn to news reports. We can listen to our grandmothers, our aunts, our cousins, our mothers, or even hear from our own experiences or our colleagues that we work with if we really want to hear about how Black women's leadership is being challenged. And I'm so grateful, Christian, that you brought this tie in, because we know and we have data that shows us that these attacks begin far before Black women are seasoned leaders, right? The hostility towards Black women, the unfair expectations, the limited opportunities, the strain on their health and well-being begins in girlhood. And that's why I wanted to bring in that resource, Girlhood Interrupted, The Erasure of Black Girls' Childhood. It was a report that was conducted by Georgetown University. We, in that report, are able to see the ways that Black girls, by the ages of 5 years old to 14 years old, are viewed by adults. These beliefs about Black women are starting in their girlhood. And the report shows that compared to white girls of the same age, Black girls need less nurturing, Black girls need less protection, Black girls need to be supported less, Black girls need to be comforted less, Black girls are more independent. What is the cumulative impact of these perceptions? As we were just talking about these biases that start to build in our heads, we would argue, and the report would argue, is that the treatment of Black girls and the opportunities that Black girls receive are connected to these unfair and harmful attributions that we assign to Black girls. So we even see this evidenced in social media. I don't know if you guys are TikTokers, but you know, there's that viral TikTok where they show that social experiment with a young Black girl and the young white girl who were left alone. The white girl left by herself got all the attention she needed to be safe. People were coming up to her, asking where her folks were, asking if she was okay. But the Black girl was ignored. People just walked right by her. And so the Georgetown report and studies like this suggest that we also see this in our schools, with the perception of Black girls as less innocent might contribute to harsher punishment. Or the view that Black girls need less nurturing and protection and support and are more independent may translate into fewer leadership and mentorship opportunities. So when we think about what we need to transform, we need to think about the ecosystems that girls live within in order to counteract this narrative. That's what we need to address, right? And at the same time, we must center the leadership of girls to create the conditions they need for themselves, their families, and their communities to thrive. And that is why I'm so excited about the Advancing Girls Fund. And that's what I'm so excited about what we're trying to do. This fund centers the voices of girls and young women of color and their allies to shape these solutions, right? We pour into their well-being, advocacy, and leadership. But as we've been talking about over and over again in this huge call to action, we are far out-resourced. Despite all that the fund has done, we are far out-resourced because the anti-gender movement is heavily resourced and organized. And so we need right now champion donors to join us in the fight for girls so we can interrupt this legacy of harm that we've been talking about today and write a new story where Black girls and women's leadership and their health and well-being is supported so that Black girls and women are thriving. So we must begin in girlhood. They're directly connected.
It's so powerful, Aaliyah. The point you make around the narrative, which is supported by the data you offer, reminds me of some work by Bell Hooks, a Black feminist author, who talks about how in the United States, we've made Black women either subhuman or superhuman, and not just recognizing their humanity. And we have these stereotypes of Black girl magic and you can do anything. Or we have these stereotypes that hypersexualize them or hypermaternalize them. And so we have in our socialization, which becomes our biases, a set of stereotypes that we claim that we don't act on, but the data prove differently. The data prove that we do not think of Black women as just human beings with the same emotional, psychological, and physical needs, wants, desires as any other human. We make them either more than that as a means of rejecting them, or we think of them as subhuman.
Thank you. Yes to all that.
Can I ask? This is a lot of heaviness, both of acknowledging where we currently are at and the needs that exist, and the importance for us to address and change. And I want to ask, what gives you the drive to continue your work? What gives you hope, and maybe the lens of a critical hope where we do acknowledge the challenges and the inequities that exist? What gives you hope to drive the work that you are driving? And what can you leave folks listening with in order to ride along that train of hope and action? How can we take some of our learnings from this conversation, and how can we apply that organizationally? How can we have that hope and that passion to change things on an organizational level?
Sure. Thank you for that. For me personally, the hope comes from what I would refer to as a spiritual place. I think earlier I talked about Dr. King saying the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. So for me, I have to have some belief that even when we see things that appear to be moving backwards, even when the work gets tedious, that there is some progress that's happening on a universal scale or on a continuum of time that is beyond my life expectancy. So again, hearkening on Dr. King, like, remember him saying, I may not be with you when we get to the promised land, but I've seen the promised land. I've been to the other side, is what he said. And so for me, I can imagine, envision, believe in a day and time where there is a more just world. And so I feel like it's just my mission for my life to do justice, love mercy, walk humbly. And it can be frustrating individually and collectively when you do the work. However, there has to be something greater than oneself that helps to drive the work. And for me, that's certainly the case. And so then, like, what happens inside of an organization, or when you think about something organization-wide, the work itself has to be both internal and external, or inside out, meaning we have to do our own work through critical self-reflection to examine our own beliefs, values, biases, and confront those through education, through understanding, through community building. And at the same time, as we start to understand and have a shared perspective, or what I call a worldview or lens around JEDI, then we can all work together to apply that lens to policies, practices, procedures. I think part of the challenge sometimes is folks want to jump right to policies, right to procedures, and rightfully so, because those are the things that uphold systems. However, the policies are the way they are because we have failed to confront our implicit biases, and we've built policies inside of institutions and systems that exacerbate or expand on those biases, whether it be explicit or implicit. So the work is inside out, acknowledging my own biases and opportunities for growth, working on my own growth so that we can then fix our institutions and systems.
Thank you for that, Dr. Christian. Aaliyah, to reiterate the question, what does give you hope on that individual level to continue the work mm-hmm. that you are doing in light of all the challenges that Black women face? And also, what can you share with folks to shift their thinking, especially in the philanthropy world, for mm-hmm. donors, for folks who are fund managers, to think about the sector, to think about supporting, and to be a little bit more critical, and maybe even critique their own choices of where their funds are going, and to be open to that critique? Could you share with us?
Yeah, great questions, Christian. Individually, what gives me hope are Black girls, Black women. They're who give me hope. I'm the mother of five, three of which are Black girls. I am the grandmother, or Uma, as I go by, of a Black granddaughter. And so they give me hope. Their joy gives me hope. Their innovation, their ideas, their intelligence, their resilience, all those things give me hope. If we can just tap into even a little bit of what they have to offer, we'll be better for it. And the grantee partners fall in that as well. To witness the work that these girls are doing, advancing the most critical issues, name an issue, there is a young Black woman or young woman of color or their ally at the front lines of it. So we can sit in like the despair, but these individuals, without the resources that they need, are advancing work that we're all riding the coattails of. They're making the world better for all of us. Not just for girls of color, but for all of us. And so that's what really gives me hope, is that these young women and girls aren't just advancing their own self-interest. It's all of our shared self-interest. So that gives me a lot of hope and a lot of excitement for the work. When I think about the things that need to happen, I really think there's three things. Number one, we need to move upstream. We need to disrupt what we're seeing happen with Black women and other women of color by focusing our resources during girlhood, when the attacks on their leadership and well-being are beginning. So that's number one. So move upstream. Number two, as we talked about earlier, and I'm glad that Dr. Christian brought forward, like, we need to shift our narratives and our perceptions about how we see Black girls and young women of color, which is resulting in harmful practices and policies. And to reference the recent webinar that we hosted, one of our guests was Joanne Smith. She's the founder and president of Girls for Gender Equity, and she's one of the Advancing Girls Fund grantee partners. She brought forth the words of Layla Motley. She's the author of Night Crawling. She's a young and gifted author who said it best when she said, "We owe Black children the gift of childhood." We owe them that. And so we must challenge these narratives and these perceptions that rob them of their childhood, right? And lastly, we need to invest in girls, right? Joanne also said, we act against our own humanity when we don't resource the youngest of us. Let me say that again. We act against our own humanity when we don't resource the youngest of us. And investing less than 1% of foundation funding in girls and women of color, we can do better. They deserve more. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask an extra question? Mm-hmm. Because I think it's very powerful from what I'm hearing from both of y'all. It reminds me of the personal is political. And I heard a little bit about that from your sharing, Aaliyah, and puts your work in context of being a mother of five children. Mm-hmm. And your work is not just work, it's life. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's why I hear passion coming out. And as a little extra, could the both of you give me your thoughts on that interplay of that personal mm-hmm. and those experiences into the drive for your work? Because I think that can be very powerful when we share a little bit of that insight, because we have to acknowledge there's a person behind these positions, and we get lost a little bit behind LinkedIn. And I think that's the power of these conversations, and that's what I'm receiving as a listener from what y'all are sharing. So could you just touch a little bit on that, Aaliyah?
Yeah, I'm so happy you brought that forward. When we think about every indicator around quality of life, Black people are lagging behind in that indicator, every indicator. And so when I look at that, and I look at these five beautiful Black children and my beautiful granddaughter, I think to myself, there's no reason that they should live less years just because of the color of their skin and how they're racialized, right? they shouldn't get paid less just because of that. They should be offered every opportunity to develop their leadership, to show up in spaces, to shift the outcomes and have some autonomy over their lives. And so it's very personal. And as we celebrate the beauty and the achievements of Black people, we can hold that joy and all the innovations and all the inventions and all the cultural and social capital and amazingness of Black people, and still hold at the same time that when we look at every indicator around well-being, that our community is lagging behind, and it has nothing to do with the individual characteristics of our community and everything to do with what Christian has been talking about as these historical and current day structures and systems that are disadvantaging Black women, Black men, Black families, and other marginalized groups and other folks of color as well. So that's what drives me. It is very personal. It is political. And it's something I believe, as I said earlier, just to leave a positive note, it's something that we can do something about. Because as Christian talks about, you know, in his work, these systems and structures were created. And if they're created, they can be dismantled. And we together can collectively co-create something new. And that's the invitation for Tides, is to join us, walk alongside us. If you are as passionate as we are about the lives of girls and about the lives of communities and about your communities in which these girls exist, then join us.
How about you, Christian? What drives you on that personal level? What is that relevancy of that personal as political to your work, to your Jedi work?
Yeah, there's a few things that come to mind immediately. One of the things is just genetics, like my lineage, my ancestry. I know for a fact that my ancestors, many of them, or some of them, were brought to this country as enslaved Africans. We can trace it to a port in Maryland. I can go to my grandmother's house or my uncle's house in Virginia, where they still live on the land where my family was enslaved. And I can see the graves of my ancestors, not too distant, who were born before 1865 in Chesterfield County, Virginia. Therefore, they were born into slavery, and I see the evidence of their persistence through slavery. And that keeps me inspired. And I imagine that I am a culmination of some of their dreams, given the idea that I can work towards social justice, racial justice, economic justice, and get paid to do it in the United States is probably something that they never imagined would be a possibility. So I always try to keep that in perspective. And I'll also just say, like, leaning on this theme of genetics, I really believe that this is about science and not just emotion. And in a world where control of the narrative is really powerful and there's attempts to distort truths in order to control that narrative, one of the things that always rings true to me is that we know from biological genetic evidence that the first human beings were born in Africa, created or existed in Africa. And if you then just follow the reasoning, that means that every human being after was birthed by a Black woman. So all of humanity and civilization was birthed by Black women. And people might hear that and think it's hyperbole, but in reality, it's just science. And when we have an erasure of the facts around science and history, then it leads to inequities. So part of what continues to drive me or is personal to me is not just my own family's experience, but my extended ancestry back through time, the genetic linkage to the fact that Black women are the creators of humanity. And that's important to me.
Thank you very much, the both of you, for sharing your wisdom and your thoughts and lived experiences on this topic to celebrate Black History Month and Black leadership and Black excellence. Thank you. Are there any last thoughts you would like to share before we close out? And I'll ask you, Aaliyah, in all love and gratitude.
Yeah, well, I just want to extend love and gratitude. Thank you so much for offering this opportunity. Thank you, Tides. Thank you to our Jedi work for offering up this opportunity to highlight the work that we're doing internally and how it's translating to the work that we're doing externally alongside our grantee partners. I feel very privileged, as Christian talked about, to be able to do this work, to be able to advance my passion and my expertise and my interest in this way alongside this critical fund and in this organization who has shared values and a shared mission. So just thank you.
Thank you, Aaliyah. Dr. Christian Friend, thank you as well. Love and appreciation. A lot of learnings that I'll have to follow up on. Do you have any last thoughts for us?
Well, just an appreciation for you, for just the opportunity to share in this conversation, and appreciation for Tides and the work it does to advance these issues around social justice. And glad to be a part of it. So thanks and gratitude. That's all I have.
Awesome. Thank you both.